We're going to talk about one of the most important figures in jazz history, especially the fact that she is one of the most incredible female jazz artists, one of the most successful, one of the first. And we're going to talk about her journey. She was born in Atlanta, Georgia, as Mary Elfrida Scruggs. And that's not the name we know her by. She was born in 1910 in Atlanta. And her family soon moved to the Liberty section of Pittsburgh. Big Presbyterian church there, very old, that a lot of blacks attended. And that is where she grew up, in what was a budding integrated neighborhood. And it is that situation that caused her to learn to play the piano. You see, when the family moved into this neighborhood, they were welcomed by hostile neighbors who did not think blacks should live on the same block with them. So they had lots of bricks in their house. I'm not talking about the bricks that established the walls and outer circumference of the building. I'm talking about bricks that came in through the windows. So young Mary, at about 3 years of age, started experimenting with the piano just to calm her own nerves and give her some little degree of comfort in this very hostile situation. Well, what was soon discovered is that she was a natural prodigy on this instrument. And pretty soon, people in the neighborhood could hear her playing, even at 3 and 4, and were like, ooh, that's marvelous. And even as a young child, Mary wasn't stupid. So she would sometimes visit her neighbors' homes and sit and play little impromptu concerts. And the more of these little concerts she played for her neighbors, the fewer bricks came through the windows. So her early journeys into music were to escape the hostility around her, but because she chose music as a place to escape through, and because she had this incredible talent, she's this great little prodigy, and because she was not afraid to share it, she established peace for everybody. At 3, 4, 5 years of age, in this once hostile Pittsburgh neighborhood. Well, she continued to play. Got herself some lessons, some training, and became quite the incredible little pianist. By 12, she's on the Orpheus theater circuit. These are live shows that go into these big theaters, you know, with some of the biggest names around. And at 12, she is appearing on shows, regional shows in the Pittsburgh area, Cleveland, Buffalo, Erie, Pennsylvania, probably some little towns in West Virginia, Ohio, Columbus, all those things that are close, Cincinnati maybe. And she's appearing with people like Duke Ellington and McKinley's Cotton Pickers. What a name for a band. And Louis Armstrong. And the word is, the first time Louis heard her, she was 12 years of age. And Louis just rushed over to the stage and picked her up and gave her a big hug. He was so impressed with this little 12-year-old. And we're talking about the great Satchmo now. So she is definitely being recognized, but she's 12. And these are just little tours, and she go back home to Pittsburgh. By 15, she said, we may have to do this, because this is what I love, and this is what I love to do. Her mentor, her guide in all of this, had been a woman from the earlier age of jazz called Lovey. And Lovey was a pianist and an arranger and composer. And had worked with Louis Armstrong and Joe Oliver and a lot of blues singers, and was very, very famous and very, very well-to-do, especially around Chicago. They say that Lovey drove a Stutz Bearcat. It's a custom sports car, yeah. Even back in these days, this sister dressed to the nines, drove a custom sports car, all because of her talent as a jazz pianist and arranger. And this was the person that Mary patterned herself after. Well, soon she's on the road playing with this group and that group and this group and that group. And at some point, she gets into McKinney's Cotton Pickers. And there's a saxophone player in there with the last name Williams. And pretty soon they married. So now she's not Mary Elfrida Scruggs, she's Mary Elfrida Williams. And this relationship goes real well for a while. They're touring together, they're playing together. Everything seems to be going pretty well. She's starting to attract the attention of some big people, not just for her piano skills, but because she's a trained musician, and like Lovey, she could write music. So she was writing music for Fletcher Henderson. And Fletcher, of course, was writing for his own bands and every other band around, and even for the great Benny Goodman. And soon, Lil Mary is writing for Benny Goodman. And she's even writing for Duke Ellington. That's right. And Andy Kirk and a lot of other people that had big bands that needed great arrangements. So this is the 30s, and she is getting famous as a great arranger. And she has her own little bands. And as we close out the 30s and move into the 40s, we got this new music coming through called bebop. Well, she's a trained musician. She's holding down a gig at Cafe Society. Some of you all may remember Cafe Society. That's the place that Billie Holiday got in trouble for singing Strange Fruit, same joint. Yeah, well, Mary Lou Williams, she was finally told to change that Elfrida to Lou to make it easier on people about record producing. So she became Mary Lou Williams. Easier to say, easier to remember. And she's working, man. Here and there and everywhere, the biggest clubs. And it's working out great. And she's right there as the whole bebop thing is happening. And all the bebop cats are made to her, because not only can she play it, she knows it in her head. She can write it down. She's got the whole theory stuff. And bebop was all about experimentation. And she had the knowledge to do experimentation. So you know what? When she would finish her gigs at 1 a.m. and go to her apartment, Tad Dameron might show up. Dizzy Gillespie might show up. Thelonious Monk might show up. Jack Teagarden might show up. All of them might show up to sit with Mary Lou Williams and learn the intricacies of jazz, harmony, reharmony, bitonality, etc. They're discussing all of these concepts and they're moving this music into the next phase, which is going from swing into bebop. That's Mary Lou Williams. You might say she was a professor in the University of Bebop, but we don't know her. Why is that? Now you know. Now you know. And all these guys sang her praises. And she did this all the time. This is what jazz musicians do. We don't just go out and play a gig and then go home. No, no, no. We go play a gig and then we go find some more musicians to hang out with and share with and continue this experiment because we love this thing we do. It doesn't stop. So is Mary Lou Williams. Now, somewhere around 1945, she decided to write a piece that is immersed with classical influences. It's 12 movements. It's called the Zodiac Suite. And basically, 12 months, 12 movements for each zodiac sign. And she dedicated each movement to a friend or colleague that was born under one of those signs. Yeah, there was a movement for Billie Holiday. There's a movement for Charlie Parker. There's a movement for Diz. There's a movement for quite a few people. And she wrote this piece for them. And it was groundbreaking. A jazz musician writing what we call third stream music, a blend of jazz and classical music, making it a suite, and then tying it to specific heroes in their life. Who ever heard of such a thing? She started to make her own recordings as a solo pianist with groups and whatnot. That is going really, really well. She's starting to get a little buzz in Europe. So in 1952, she decided to take a trip to England. And it was supposed to be like a gig, and you come back. Well, she stayed 2 years because she was so in demand and she loved it. She loved it. But she was working so much, there was so much demand for her time, she was eating and breathing music. And she got lost in this musical world and not in a good way. And somewhere around 1954, while playing in Paris, she simply stood up and backed away from the piano and did not touch it again for 3 years. This was a transition. She came back to America. She converted to Catholicism. And she spent the next few years going to Mass and studying Catholicism for real. She completely immersed herself in Catholicism the same way she had completely immersed herself in jazz and music. She got involved with causes, the Bel Canto Foundation, that dealt with addiction, primarily drug addiction. This was dear to her because she was already seeing the effects of this on friends that she had in the music industry, Tad Dameron and Miles Davis and Charlie Parker and so many other of her great friends, Billie Holiday. And so she got involved in that movement. And she started thrift shops and foundations and whatever she could do to raise money to support drug intervention, drug treatment, not jail. Intervention, treatment. And all of this came through the auspices initially of the Catholic Church and their Bel Canto Foundation. In that time, she met Father Peter O'Brien, who's another legendary figure in jazz. They called him the Jazz Priest. He was well known at Newport and other main events. Very big jazz educator. And because Mary Lou had gone into the Catholic Church, the two of them were drawn to each other, and soon he became her manager and got her back to doing, let's say, safe things. Not so much bars, but cottage gigs, workshops, recording, charitable events. But then her friend Dizzy Gillespie convinced her, come on girl, we miss you. You need to come on back and play a little bit. I got this gig coming up and you need to be on this gig. Everybody's missing you. They need to see you one more time, baby, come on. So at the Newport Jazz Festival in 1957, Mary Lou Williams made her re-entry, baby. She walks on the stage as a part of Dizzy Gillespie's group, and the world went, thank you, thank you, thank you. Here is that voice we have been missing. Here is that personality we have been missing. Here is our leader who we have been missing. And that was the beginning of the second phase of her career. Now she continued to concentrate on liturgical music. She wrote several masses. She wrote all kinds of music that blended classical influence and jazz influences. But understand this, in her career, she had recorded over 100 records, despite the time she took off as a performer. She had also written over 100 arrangements and compositions, some for the biggest, most famous bands and orchestras in the world. She was prolific. Father O'Brien persuaded her to start working with kids that are part of this charitable thing she was doing. So she started teaching kids jazz history, and then jazz performance. And then she started teaching students and advanced students. And this led to her getting a visiting artist in residence position at Duke University, where she assisted Father O'Brien in teaching jazz history and directing the Duke Jazz Orchestra. Didn't know that, did you? Yes. And she kept that job. Yes, she did. She made her last recordings at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 1978. I think it's a solo piano recording. You might want to get that one to really check out what this lady was all about. But she continued to teach at Duke, and I think somewhere around 1981, it was discovered that she had bladder cancer, and soon after she died in Durham, North Carolina. And all the greats came to the funeral, which was held right there in Durham. Dizzy came, Andy, Kurt came, a lot of people who were with her in the heydays of the 40s and 50s and 60s were long gone, but those who had survived it, those that she had provided a pathway with all of her work with the Bel Canto Foundation, her work with drug intervention, et cetera, they came. And she was finally laid to rest at the Catholic Cemetery in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This is Mary Lou Williams. One of the things that we do poorly is, as James Brown said, it's a man's world, it's a man's world, it's a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. So let's try to remember that. And let's elevate the likes of Mary Lou Williams that may not have the voice in terms of public appeal and advertisement and all that propaganda, but their contributions are huge. And among musicians, even the men who are more famous and make this music, they are the true heroes. And there are few more important in this discussion than Mary Lee Williams or Mary Lou Williams. So please remember Mary Lou Williams, who started playing at 3 just to bring down the temperature in her neighborhood and discover she was a prodigy, and then spent the rest of her life making music and goodwill toward all men. Thank you, Mary Lou Williams.